Involvement with the criminal justice system is life-changing. It matters.
Having a justice system that works is a really important part of a democratic society.
I'm Penelope Gibbs, Director of Transform Justice.
I'm Rob Allen. I've worked in and around criminal justice all my career.
This is the Transform Justice podcast, throwing light on the criminal justice system.
Hearing from people who know.
It's about whether the system's fair.
And what can be done to make it better.
Today we're going to discuss whether there's racism in the courts of England and Wales, particularly amongst judges. I'm joined by Keir Monteith KC, co-author of a report on racial bias in the judiciary, and by Abimbola Johnson. Abimbola is a barrister and chairs the Independent Scrutiny Board for the police's Race Action Plan, a plan to support forces to become anti-racist. I'm also joined by my co-host, Rob Allen. Rob, the Lammy Review analysed how ethnic minority defendants were discriminated against in the criminal justice system. What did David Lammy say about judges and the decisions they made?
Well, you're right, Penelope. David Lammy concluded that ethnic minority people do face bias, including overt discrimination in parts of the justice system. One of the things he recommended was a system of online feedback on how judges conduct cases, but the government said this wouldn't be consistent with the principle of judicial independence, so it didn't get off the ground.
In fact, from what I can gather, very little of what Lammy said about judges got off the ground. Keir, can you give an example, either from your report or your experience, of a judge behaving in a racist way?
Sadly, there's many examples, and the figures speak for themselves in terms of how black and ethnic minority defendants are imprisoned at a much greater rate than their white counterparts. The report that we were involved in, there are numerous examples that we found of a disparaging attitude, interrupting of witnesses, trivializing evidence that has been given. And it can be done in subtle ways. So in tone, facial expressions, demeanor, and sometimes explicit, so references to you people. It can be as simple as smiles and maybe jokes in relation to the prosecution or relation to white witnesses. But what was described to us as a scowl when speaking to ethnic minority defendants or indeed lawyers. It really was, in terms of our report, the tip of the iceberg. We picked out only part of the evidence that we had received.
Yeah. Abby, have you come across or experienced judges being racially biased in the work that you do?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I spent 10 years working as a criminal defence barrister. Some of the anecdotal evidence that Keir has pointed to, I've seen or experienced directly. There was one in particular that always sticks in my mind, and this is a judge who sat at Isleworth, and he used to routinely, if he had a defendant of colour come before him, ask them what their immigration status was, even when it had absolutely no relevance to the matter that was before him. And he never once, in my experience, asked that of a white defendant. It was always a completely obvious example of him racially profiling the defendants who came before him. And there's a threat behind that. If one of the first things that you do as a judge who sits in a very dominant position in a courtroom is to question somebody's legal status in the country, it sets a tone that they are not one of the people who are welcome in that room, that you are in some way going to take that into account in the way that you interact with them. And if he really had been curious about anybody's status, he could have just looked at the documentation before him, which would have told him whether or not somebody was British. So a lot of it as well was him, I think, enjoying that power dynamic. I found it appalling. I would challenge him on it. I didn't ever see a white barrister challenging him on it. I don't know if they even picked up on the fact that he was doing it just to defendants of colour. So we really do have a duty as counsel to remain alert to those potential examples of injustice and really pushing for those changes as and where we can.
I've got to agree with Abby on that. I'm continually surprised at the lack of scrutiny from both sides in situations where racism is occurring and in relation to other matters where judges are bullies. And counsel tend not to stand up against the judge, because if it doesn't affect them directly, when they come to pursue an argument in relation to their client, they don't want the baggage of having had a complaint made against the judge.
There's also that concern that you have of how this will reflect on the way that the judge will interact with your client. And very rarely do we have an opportunity to kind of turn around and say to our client, do you want me to say something about the fact that he has asked you that question? I think that a lot of people use it as an excuse to then be a non-actor around the racism that they see, rather than just sitting back and allowing that to be a reason not to do anything. You must see it as your duty to then have the conversation with your client, to highlight what you have seen, to come up with suggestions and solutions around how the issue can be navigated, and then to take instructions from them.
Yeah. I mean, I quite see that it's hard in the middle of a case to raise some of these things. But once a case is finished, is there any scope for making a complaint? Is there a way you can take some action after the matter's been resolved, thereby not prejudicing your client's interest? Is that possible, Keir?
Well, it's too late, isn't it? According to our report, it's exceptionally rare that you would ever have the complaints procedure upholding a complaint on the basis of racism. So when we completed our report in November of last year, we could only find one upholding of a complaint on the basis of racism in the maybe hundreds of cases that have gone through the system. And we point out that there is a clear lack of correlation between one single upheld complaint and what we found in our survey results in relation to institutional racism within the justice system.
But if I could play devil's advocate, the lawyers complained in your survey of all these instances of racism. Surely there's an onus on lawyers themselves, if they're complaining to you, to actually complain to official authorities about these things.
Racism is pretty much always underreported by those who are the victims of it. That's a trend that you see across any form of discrimination. There is a form of weathering which occurs. If you are somebody who is already sitting in an environment where there is racial bias surrounding you, so very often as a criminal defence barrister, the only other black face in the room would be my defendant who was sitting in the dock. So you're painfully aware already that you are up against a system that disproportionately affects those who share your skin colour. And then the work itself is emotionally draining. You have the weight of prosecuting, defending, very often defending if you are a black barrister. So I can understand why black and brown barristers underreport the racism that they see, because it's an extra burden upon us and an aspect of work that actually we would rather not take home. And you have concerns that you will not be believed, that you'll put all of this effort into writing out the complaint, but ultimately the procedure itself is not really adequately constructed to deal with those matters. My question very often is, what about those people who don't have those characteristics and therefore don't have that burden, but do have that duty of care, not just towards their clients, but also as an officer of the court, to ensure that they are working in a system that is fair? First of all, do they even recognise those issues as racist? And I think that there are some other points here that we need to consider around the legal profession. I've never had compulsory anti-racism training as part of my journey to the bar. I have undertaken it because it's something that I'm particularly interested in, but that's often work that I've had to seek out myself. So there's an onus on us as council to even make ourselves more sensitive to these matters, to know to highlight them, and also to step in and take on the mantle of raising those complaints when they deal with areas that don't directly affect us because of our characteristics.
Yeah, Keir, can I just ask you about training? It's often put forward as a sort of an attempt to try and change attitudes and reduce bias. But is it the answer, do you think, training, or is something more needed?
Training isn't the answer. Superficially attractive, but it's clearly not working. So I'll give you a prime example. The top people, top judges, are in the Supreme Court, and they recognise that there's no black people there, or brown people. And the leader of the court made the observation that he hoped by the time he retires, which is 2026, there'd be at least one black or brown Supreme Court justice. Now, if they'd actually gone on some decent anti-racist training, they wouldn't even be hoping that. It would have happened. So training doesn't provide an answer to the problem that we have. It's an acknowledgement of the problem of institutional racism. And it's very difficult, it seems, for those at the top to actually publicly acknowledge it. And then you get into structural change. And part of that would involve anti-racist training.
For some listeners, I don't think they would know, what is anti-racism?
It's to actually take proactive action in situations where racism is evident, and in particular for judges to lead from the front. And on the occasions that happens, it does shine a light. And we actually did find in our report examples where judges were acting in an anti-racist way. So there was a recognition during a sentencing exercise where the judge noted that racism had played a part in where the defendant found themselves. And that was actually taken into account during the sentence. And further, it was acknowledged that for the lawyer, who was a lawyer of colour, going through the advocacy of putting that forward was difficult, but it was congratulated by this particular judge. And that, it would seem to us, was a breath of fresh air, but it is in the minority of the evidence we received back from the survey. And in terms of the example I've just given, it is right to note that the judge was described as mixed race, mixed heritage, and also importantly, that that individual never progressed to being a circuit judge and no longer sits as a judge. So the story would be very, very different if, after being vocally anti-racist, that was recognised, congratulated, and that individual rose through the ranks. But the end of that story is rather sad.
Abby, have you seen this proactive anti-racism in action amongst the judiciary?
No, I haven't seen examples of proactive anti-racism. I have had occasions where I've seen judges being receptive to certain types of arguments being raised before them rather than just being completely dismissive of them, which I think is always a concern that people have.
Mm. Training may have its limitations. What about guidance? Courts have had this equal treatment bench book for many years now, I think, and it's revised periodically to provide guidance on these sorts of things. Do you think judges read it, use it, abide by it, or is it something that just sits on a shelf?
There's no acknowledgement in that quite lengthy tome now of institutional racism, despite everything that we've found. So if it is read by the judges, and I think a number do read it, the starting point, certainly from where I'm coming from and the authors of Racial Bias and the Bench come from, is that it's wrong. We recommended that it required a significant review and consideration in terms of the editorial board. So you had anti-racist experts on it, that it's not completely and utterly made up of judges. And you have that input from lived experience. And so that you have a textbook that acknowledges the problem.
But also, it's not about any one thing. The point of looking at matters through an anti-racist lens is that you recognise that we are sitting within an overall system that allows for racism to fester. And so you have to be willing to challenge those systems itself. And I think that one of the aspects that comes through in a lot of these reports is recommendations that look at specifically just at training or at guidance or mentoring or even just recruitment, getting more people of colour through the door, but still expecting them to align with the pre-existing culture and to use the pre-existing material. None of that challenges the underlying problem. So I think the only way to really imbue anti-racism is to take a systemic approach to these matters. That would mean things like rethinking how we look at crime, really taking into account the overall structure in society and the different starting positions that people come to when they end up in the courtroom, thinking of solutions that may divert people away from the criminal justice system, being willing to provide judges with a wider discretion to think of creative solutions rather than having to follow kind of formulaic processes. But of course, if you give people a wider discretion, you need to be assured that they are going to apply that discretion in a way that's guided by anti-racist principles.
It seems to me that many of the top judiciary are scared of the word racism. And so when you look at their five-year plan, which is what our report was set up to review and consider, literally the word racism isn't mentioned at all in a plan that's designed to deal with diversity and inclusion.
I mean, that surely is at the root of the problem here, that the judges who speak out don't mention that there may be any racism anywhere in the courts.
Exactly. It's as if it doesn't exist. The hackles go up, and we need a proper grown-up conversation and acceptance that it exists. And it's no great surprise. Dame Casey has said the same about the police force. Well, Abby knows more about this because she works in that area, but they're unable at the moment, certainly in England, to accept that. Different story up in Scotland.
Well, we have some police chiefs who have accepted the existence of institutional racism. So, for example, very recently, the Avon and Somerset chief constable accepted it. But on the rare occasion that you do see people overtly discussing matters like institutional racism, what's followed is almost immediately a backlash. So almost straight after she made that admission, you saw the chair of the local police federation released quite a scathing press release around how undermining it was for her to do that and that she was effectively calling all of his officers racist, which she wasn't. One of the issues that we have in society is that discussion of racism or labelling racism itself is more controversial than the racism. And so an anti-racist approach, for example, means flipping that perspective, and it means actually concentrating on the harms of racism and coming up with solutions that deal with those rather than the comfort of the racial majority whose harm of racism is being accused of being it rather than the actual manifestation of racism itself. Going back to these matters then, what do we do to actually solve this problem? We need to have a judiciary who are equipped to even point to, highlight, discuss and come up with solutions around racism. And as Keir has pointed out, there are people who have anti-racist expertise, and we have to also accept that we have a dearth of people who wear the uniform of being a barrister or being a solicitor, who have those anti-racist skills. And that's why it's important to bring that expertise in and also to make it compulsory for people to become more aware of those matters before they occupy elevated positions, such as sitting as members of the judiciary.
And Keir, I don't know if you saw it, but there was a kind of secret report last year that had been done by the judiciary about bullying, particularly, that the Lord Chief Justice had been given. And this article mentioned that a judicial support network had been launched by a group of judges who were worried that senior judges do bully, particularly ethnic minority and women judges. Is this a problem that you've come across?
Yes, and the Judicial Support Network were very helpful in relation to our report, and their membership has grown. They, from what I have heard, receive numerous complaints in terms of how their judicial members have been treated, how they've been bullied, and there's been some victories recently in court in terms of payouts to judges who've been treated in that way. And what's followed from that is a setting up of a trade union for judges now. And who would think it? Who would think in a justice system that there was a need to protect judges from racism, from sexism, from homophobia, from bullying, and from harassment? And who would believe in recent time that judges have been successful in taking the system to court?
But I don't think it is surprising. We live in a society that manifests racism, and it's going to be present in pretty much every organisational structure unless that structure has been built with anti-racism in mind. And obviously the criminal justice system is not built in that way. The criminal justice system is around crime and punishment. And so I think we have to move past conversations that express surprise or shock when we see these patterns repeating themselves.
Nonetheless, people aren't lawyers. I think most of them would be surprised to find that their courts are built on racial bias. 95% of the people we surveyed concluded that there was evidence of racial bias in the process and decision-making in the justice system. I'm surprised by that.
I'm not saying that people are not surprised. I'm saying the surprise shows the lack of understanding of what racism truly is. And that, to me, is quite frustrating. You know, I sit in many, many conversations where a report comes out and a lot of the discussion sits around, oh, does this mean this is institutionally racist? And what do we do about this? And, oh, we should go and speak to our black friends and colleagues. We should do this, we should do that. And my frustration is, well, you should have known that this was happening because these systems were never constructed with an anti-discriminatory lens.
I agree with you, Abby, but I do also think that reports which evidence the racism actually get to the people who haven't recognised it already sometimes.
To be clear, I think that these reports remain very important. Keir's report is important, and Casey's report is important. I guess my point is, my reaction is not surprise to the racism. My reaction is frustration that we still need to have these reports to make people alert to the existence of racism. And my point is that the starting point ought to be, by now, that people just understand racism is insidious and present. And unless you proactively come up with solutions for these, it's going to be present in your organisation and in your institution. So, for example, when the Stephen Lawrence Inquiry report came out in 1999, that should have been a prompt to other institutions to say, we must have this issue here as well, because we are also built on these apparently similar values. We are also a proudful organisation who is here to eradicate these injustices, but we have similar disproportionate numbers of white staff compared to the population. And that's my point. Why does it take these very specific, very well-written and researched reports before the conversations even really gain momentum or in some cases even start?
Yeah, isn't it because it is a vicious circle? And if the institution is institutionally racist, those at the top won't see it.
Yeah.
They won't accept it. They will get upset when the R word is mentioned, and in particular, the IR two words are mentioned, institutional racism. And there's going to be pushback, as there has been, in relation to our report. And nothing has changed.
Now, I wanted to ask that. Has there been any public response by the senior judiciary to your findings and recommendations, Keir?
There has, in the sense that the present Lord Chief Justice acknowledged the report, read the report, and said it would be taken into account. But in relation to our 10 recommendations, nothing has happened. There has been a revision of the equal treatment bench book, but nothing significant has changed. And what we need are those anti-racist judges. We need them to speak out, to break the vicious circle, and then we can begin to see some real change. Otherwise, I can predict now, in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, there's going to be another report, no doubt highlighting that things have got worse.
Yeah. So the thing that struck me about your report was that the first recommendation was the acceptance of the existence of institutional racism. And to have the judiciary do that would mean that they would first of all need to have substantive conversations around racism. It wouldn't be sufficient, would it, Keir, to just have one person say, fine, we're institutionally racist, and then that be it. It needs to be an admission which reflects a change of perspective amongst the judiciary. So it needs to be an acceptance from people who have done the work to lay that foundation, so that the acceptance marks a change, and also people who will then stick around to embody that change.
I can see things with the right individuals potentially changing very quickly. I look at lawyers that are up and coming, and there's a fantastic number of them who don't take any nonsense. They are anti-racist. And as a result of this report, I have been contacted by judges who, as much as you can ever say this, are going places, who were very interested in developing anti-racist training, anti-racist sentencing exercises. And if we could all sit down, maybe in a podcast like this, I could see the potential for an awful lot of agreement. And then it doesn't take much from there to then start developing, whether it's in the context of what we've suggested in our 10 recommendations or broadening that out, getting some more ideas. And then it's down to resources, and it would be an investment in the future if the government or the next government, maybe more likely, put some resources into having a truly anti-racist justice system.
Yeah, I definitely think there are those individuals who are absolutely committed to this work. But I do think that for there to be a way for this work to stick, you also have to recognise that the majority of people do not think about anti-racism work day in and day out, unfortunately. And so there has to be something as well that makes those who do not and will not prioritise this work prioritise it.
Become a judge, Abby. Become a judge.
You know, the thought of having to put somebody in prison, it's not something that I know that I could do. And therefore, on that basis, I'm not sure that I could ever be a judge. But it's more than who the individuals are that become judges. I guess what I'm trying to point to is that for this sort of thing to work, we need people who are outside of the judiciary and have that accountability power to move into that area and to push for that, because we can't just wait for people to adopt this work on a hearts and minds basis. It's not going to stick.
Okay. Fascinating conversation. Somewhat optimistic at the end there. We have to draw it to a close. Can I ask each of you in turn, if you were, say, Lord Chief Justice, is the one thing that you would do to try and combat racial bias in the judiciary, if you just had one, what would it be, Keir?
Yeah, before I answer that question, can I say Abby has to become a judge?
Ugh, no. Why, Keir?
I'm sorry. Yeah. Now, this question, although asked in a very lovely way, is misplaced, because there isn't just one thing. And if there was, then it would have been done.
Okay, the first thing you'd do then?
The first thing is an acknowledgement. If you can't acknowledge the problem of institutional racism, you'll never be able to fix it, because you'll never know what you're trying to deal with. So a public acknowledgement of the problem. And when it's from the heart and when it's meant, then things really would change.
Okay. How about you, Abby?
Legislation. If there could be more robust legislation which is passed that I think better protects people against racism and puts on a statutory footing the need for positions like the judiciary, lawyers, to have to take these matters into account in recruitment processes, in the way that they actually do their work. I think that by doing that, that embodies some of the points that you were speaking about here, because to get legislation passed, you have to repeatedly make the argument for it. You need people to turn up to vote for it. You then influence the general population. And so I think putting things into legislation can not just reflect society, but it can also steer society in a certain direction. And I think that's what we need.
Thanks very much. Thanks, Rob, Abby and Keir. And if you'd like to read any of the reports or guidance we've mentioned, do look at our programme notes. And do get us ideas for any future podcasts. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you so much for having me on, and goodbye.
Goodbye, and thank you very much for having me. Can I just add one extra thing?
Keir!
No, Keir, it's done. It's very clearly done.
Yeah, but you can add it in.
No, your submissions are late. You've missed the deadline.
Oh, that was said this morning.